very short story is that I love Langston Hughes. I grew up in Portland, Oregon, and when I moved to New York, Harlem was the first place I wanted to visit. As a writer and poet, I just needed to go to Harlem and be in this, in the city and in the space where so many Black authors and poets created. And when I came to this space and realized that it was not a museum, it wasn't a space that you could actually go into, I was heartbroken. And this is about, I don't know, 15 years ago. And so I had this idea in my head for a really long time that someone ought to do something. And you know how the story goes. We complain and complain that someone else should do something, and then you realize you gotta be that person. And so 2 years ago, I launched the Langston's Legacy campaign with a group of friends who are also authors and poets and visual artists. And we raised money to be able to lease this space and have events like this and poetry workshops for teenagers and art classes for young people. And our goal is to purchase this year. So spread the word wide, let folks know that there's something happening in Harlem, and if they want to be a part, there's so many ways to get involved. But the most important thing about tonight is this. There are formal bios that I could read, but you know, Google that, find out that they won everything you can win, that they are bestsellers, and there's so many books between the two of them. What I wanted to talk about is that as a young writer, when you get your first book deal, you're wide-eyed and happy and so excited. And there are these living legends that exist that you've only known through the books that you've read by them. So when you're at an event and you're there and they're there, you're just like, I don't, I'm in the same room as Carol Boston. I can't go say hi to Frank Morrison, you know? And then you meet them. And they hug you and say hello and ask you, how you doing, what you need, if you need advice, let me know. How can I help you with Langston Hughes' house? Mm-hmm. And they donate beautiful art and they support your work and champion you on. And you realize that you are a part of the legacy of Black writers who are making books for young people, who love our young people. And it's a beautiful thing to know living writers. Like, a lot of our young people study writers who are gone. And it's something to say, no, there are people who are alive and making work that matters. And so personally, Frank and Carol are special to me because I feel like I'm standing on their shoulders and that their work has inspired me to be a writer. And not just their artistic work, but who they are in real life. It's one thing to write for children. It's another thing to love them and go to schools and be with them and create with them and teach and nurture them. And that is what they do. So I'm very honored to have them here tonight. How this is going to work is they're just going to talk. We're just going to listen to them talk about what it means to be an artist and a poet and why they wanted to write this book and collaborate together. And then we'll open it up for questions. So please be thinking of something you want to ask. And then we'll have a signing at the end. Welcome again. And I'm going to turn it over to Carol. Oh.
Well, thank you, Renee. I'm just glad to be a living writer tonight. So that you can stand on my shoulders. And Renee told us she was going to ask the first question, and it was going to be, why hip-hop? So she got excited, so I'm going to ask, why hip-hop, Frank?
Hip-hop to me was an opportunity to express myself where I did not have to own a pair of shoes back in the 80s or own a particular product that was to be good. I wasn't fortunate enough to have all the latest Adidas, and we basically grew up with our talents. So I don't know if anybody remembers back in the day, we would race for no reason. You see kids running up the street and running back down to see who was the fastest. It didn't matter what kind of Nike you had on. It didn't matter if you wasn't fast. It didn't matter. And hip hop was a chance back in those days to express your talent, and it wasn't about, you couldn't buy the talent. You had to actually practice and be good at it. When I saw this book come across, I just was amazed that you wrote this book, because you've written so many wonderful books. And so I said, I just jumped on this opportunity to give back to our kids so they can see, so they can be inspired the way I was.
First of all, I just have to give a shout out to and give props to Langston Hughes. Because when I was in fourth grade, I was forced to memorize his poem, I Too. And from that moment on, he became my literary mentor in absentia. That was probably just a couple years before he died when I had to memorize that poem. So through Langston Hughes and through the grandmothers who lived in my household or lived just like two blocks away, I always had a grandmother in the house growing up, I was steeped in oral traditions. My grandfather was a minister, and I even grew up to marry a minister and was as they call it in the South, a first lady for about 25 years. So I was steeped in oral traditions as a result of my upbringing. I was not a child of hip-hop like Frank was, because I think I might be about maybe 20 years older than you. Maybe 15, 20 years older than you. So I was already an adult by the time hip-hop came on the scene in the late 70s. I was out of college. And to be honest, it didn't catch my attention right away, because by then I had been through R&B and been through rock and had come to jazz. I was raised on jazz because my dad was into jazz, so I had come around to my dad's music, to jazz. But I was writing poetry at the time, and I was writing what I would call jazz poetry. And I really think then, at the time, I was really writing hip-hop. But I had no idea that I was writing it, because I was writing this rhyming poetry about music, and it was very, very hip, and I was doing spoken word nights, poetry readings, we called it then. There was no such thing as a poetry slam then. But I pretty much ignored hip-hop except when I was at parties, and I would, you know. And there occasionally would be somebody freestyling at a party. But still, I was into jazz, because jazz was the thing for me. And then when I had kids, they reintroduced me to hip-hop, because I went for many years when I was raising my kids, I didn't have time for any music. I didn't have time for TV, music, nothing. All I had time to do was raise kids and write and work my day job. But I had kids, and they reintroduced me to hip-hop, and it was okay with me. And then I started teaching. And because I was so inspired by spoken word traditions, and I was still writing this poetry that maybe it was certainly influenced by spoken word traditions, and I was teaching at an HBCU, a historically black college, historically black university in North Carolina, Fayetteville State University, and the college had no hip hop course, and I thought, well, hip hop's been around for 40 years, certainly it deserves to be studied in a scholarly fashion at an HBCU. And so I created this hip-hop course. Well, I had written The Roots of Rap maybe 10 years before I even started the course and couldn't sell it. And eventually you write these manuscripts and you have them in your drawer on your flash drive. And I said, well, let me try again. And Sonali Fry bought it. It resonated with her. And she chose Frank Morrison, the wonderful Frank Morrison, for the project. And I just thought that, you know, kids needed to know about the history of hip-hop and not just know the rap that's being produced today. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I think if you are immersed in something, you need to know where it came from and know its roots. And so I wanted to, you know, we talk about digital natives, kids who are raised on computer technology. Well, they're kids who are, and they're, you know, certainly part of the hip-hop nation. They need to know the history of it. Just like we need to know the history of the country where we live. This is the language of global youth culture, and I think it deserved a book of its own.
And you know, it's weird, because when I was growing up, see, I did grow up with my dad controlled the radio in the car. You know how that works. I grew up in Jersey, so we go on these trips sometimes, and we go fishing, and we always listen to, it'd be the Temptations. I mean, they just come out with. So it was odd, because my dad had all these records, and he had like not just James Brown, Rick James, and the stuff we listened to as kids, Super Freak. I'm like, what? And we're singing that around the house. we had no idea what we were singing, especially with the Mary Jane Girls and all that stuff. But so he had a massive collection. He could have been a DJ. And we couldn't touch the records, because some of them had these risque covers on them, so you couldn't look at all the record collections, you know. So anyway, so we kept them to herself, but we controlled that radio. And this so happened one day, 2 years ago, a friend of mine came over to the record and over the radio. And I'm in the car with my dad, and he didn't turn the station. And I'm like, oh, wow, this is Run DMC. This is something I like. Now I can relate to it. And he's like, oh, he's kind of listening to it. And he's like, oh, this is rap, huh? And then, you know, he has to tell everybody, oh, this isn't real rap. This isn't real music and this and that. But he actually started tapping his hand a little. And I was like, wow. Like, I saw that generation leap there. You know, he could understand where we're coming from. And then with Sugar Hill Gang sampling, the guys from, you guys, Sugar Hill Gang, you guys, what the hell? What? Y'all don't know who Sugar Hill Gang is?
Well, I know who they are, but
So they sampled it, and I think that really kind of blended a lot, because even when hip hop went to jazz, it was almost like these rappers were trying to, or the hip hop was trying to bring in that other generation and fuse it so that we all can appreciate what's going on. So we paid homage to James Brown, so we sampled a lot of James Brown's records. And I think that's what kind of drew my parents into the hip hop. So, but I remember hearing my first hip hop song. I was in the back of my grandmother's house, and I had this old radio, and it was like, you had the little wire on it, you know, the antenna, where you gotta stretch that cord, and you gotta move around the backyard, you know, trying to get this. We can only get one little area to get the station. And I heard Planet Rock for the first time. This is like the first time I've ever heard anything that had to do with hip hop or rap. And it's Planet Rock. And I'm sitting there, and it's like something, like it just hit me. And it's like, wow, this is the freshest music I've ever heard in my life. You know, and didn't come to find out years later after doing the research from on this book, and you know, I immersed myself into, you know, what was he thinking back then? These guys, there was a movement actually happening in New York where hip hop actually was the soundtrack of a lifestyle back in the 80s. And so we had graffiti was our art, dancing was breaking, and our music was rapping. And we lived within that culture, you know? And so what ended up happening, I heard how African Bubana put that song together from mixing, going downtown to a club that was like the rock stars that bang it, like the punk rock stars. He went down to this punk rock club and he started getting in that whole vibe. And he came back to the studio and mixed that whole beat together. And once again, they're drawing in from of thinking outside the box. You know, they're just thinking like, and I think that's what hip hop is about. Recreating yourself every day and then trying to be accepted, not amongst the community, amongst your peers. Mm. And knowing that everybody around you is literally challenging themselves to be better the next day on the breaking. I don't know if you guys, anybody used to break dance here? You used to break? Yeah. Good. All right. You could spin on your head a little?
Yeah. So if we got furniture, you know, it always came with that cardboard box. You put the cardboard box outside.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
We're going to move the chairs back a little later.
Yeah. But did you break with a crew? Did you have a crew?
Just my brothers and my neighbors.
What was your move? Would you go to Up Rockin'? Were you good at popping? What was your thing?
Well, yeah, popping.
Oh, it was nice for popping,
yeah,
right?
I walk on my two hands.
Oh, you could do that? Yeah. So, but you practice
so
every day.
You learned something, didn't you?
Yeah. So, hold on. Did you battle?
Just my brothers. We were battling back and forth. And I remember, too, the movie Breaking came out.
Beach Street was we didn't go to the movies to see Beach Street. Yeah. We had to wait for someone who had a videotape, and it was like, you had to wait. And then it was like someone that was selfish because they didn't want you to see the moves. Yeah. They wouldn't let you know. You had to sneak over their house to see it or something. But that's what it was. And there was no one that had to tell us to go out there and play. Go out there and be constructive. Go out there and work out. That's all we're doing, was exercising the whole nine. When we're drawing graffiti, we're actually practicing. We're knowing colors. And hip-hop actually came in and helped develop a nation or a generation of children to teach them the arts that would never look at dancing. Like, I wasn't into tap dancing. That would, I mean, even though the Nicholas Brothers are the baddest out, you know.
Yeah.
You know, the Les Twins is dope. But I wasn't into tapping. You didn't, you wouldn't get me to tap. Yeah, I was going to tap dance. And then you wasn't going to get me to go into look at, actually, I hated fine art. I was like, Picasso? What? Really? He doesn't know how to even draw. He fixes everything around. And, you know, and with most of the Renaissance artists, I was like, what, really? Really? They're just flying people flying around in the sky? And Rembrandt cut his ear off. I'm not doing this stuff.
Not Rembrandt. Van Gogh.
Cut his ear off. Yeah, Van Gogh. Rembrandt died poor. I was like, well, why would I want to be him? So, I wasn't influenced, but these guys that were writing on the walls.
Yeah. And I think in that respect, I think hip-hop was very, and still is very democratic. Mm-hmm. Because you don't need a degree to do it. You don't need prior training to do it. Mm-hmm. But you have to have a heart for it.
Mm-hmm.
And to break dance, you don't have to go to a dance studio. You can nowadays because hip-hop has come of age and it's a commodity now. And people make money off of it. You don't have to have a PhD in English to write rhymes or to freestyle. Yet hip-hop is literature. And that's
I think what happened is that with hip-hop is a result of the community it came out of. And we were basically, when you look at the guys that did graffiti, actually graffiti is the only art form started by, American art form started by children. You think about it. This is the only American art form started by children. And now it's getting more respect now than it ever has gotten before.
I had a friend when I was in college, and I had no idea. He was like one of my little brother in college. I had no idea that he was doing graffiti because he didn't tell anybody.
No, he wouldn't.
He didn't tell anybody. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until his art, graffiti, they had the huge exhibit where all these people were lined up in the street, in the 80s for the graffiti exhibit, that I was out of touch with him by that point. Mm-hmm. But when I reconnected, he was selling paintings in Paris and in Europe. Yeah. You know, but he was one of the New York graffiti kings. Yeah. Quick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So but I had no idea. So it was, you know, the hip hop culture was all around me, even though I wasn't.
It wasn't really meant for everyone.
Right.
It wasn't meant for everyone. It was meant for kids that grew up in poverty. That's what it was. It was really meant for those kids that didn't have that way out. That they didn't have a dad that could take them out of the city. So they found a group of kids they called their crew, and they would come together and they would be their family, and they would compete against each other, and they would find positive things to do that took those kids that were doing dancing and doing what they were doing could have been doing other things. They were growing up in, you know, the worst poverty, some of these kids ever, but yet they could dance. They were drawn to the arts. And with graffiti, it's like you can't understand the lettering because it wasn't meant for everyone to understand. It's a code for other artists to understand. And it was basically something that you couldn't commercialize. You couldn't commercialize it. You couldn't put a price tag on graffiti. You couldn't put a price tag on breakdancing. And I'm hoping now it gets into the Olympics. Kids are still breaking.
It just might.
I'm hoping
it does. But skateboarding's in there, right?
Skateboarding's in. Yeah, I'm hoping breaking gets in there.
It just might.
But it was a hidden lifestyle that kids did, but it just blew up and everyone started wanting to join in to the movement, I guess.
And now it's around the world.
Around the world. So when I had to write, I pulled in a lot of, I could rap back in the day. I wasn't good. I had like one line that I borrowed from my brother. Made that happen. I just kept reciting it until my children told me to stop. I didn't go as far as the Gazelles, but I bought a little subway train and I have a ton of books. I love buying books for references and I studied, and I was just amazed when going back to those days where I didn't have, where you was on, I don't know if anybody knows Quarter Waters. Yeah, Quarter Waters. Yeah, and Bazooka Joe. You get the comic and you guys ever sent in the thing to try to get the toys that would come, the gifts?
Yes.
Yeah.
The Cracker Jacks.
Taffy, the long taffies. I just went back. I went out and bought an arcade game from the 80s. One of them stand-up arcade games, Pac-Man.
Yes.
I was trying to get that whole anything to write off. I was like, mom, I don't know.
Get in that mold. Get in the mold. Tell them I was trying to write illustrate a book. But I really went back into that movement, that year, that the 80s. Today, I just feel like hip-hop's not the same. I'm gonna be honest with you. I just feel like it's not. These guys are selling something that could kill you. Yeah, honestly, man. They're selling poison. They're not selling. We were talking about the community. We learned about, like, what KRS-One would tell us about our history. You know, I hate to say it, but I didn't know about AIDS until KRS-One talked about it. Now in the 80s, AIDS attack. So go out and get your, you know, you guys know the rest. But I didn't know about that. So it was like a public announcement.
Yeah, the first time hip-hop got my attention, beyond just, you know, partying to it, because I was in the Sugar Hill Gang, Fat Boys, Run DMC, was The Message.
Oh,
Grand Message Flash and The Furious Five.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow.
Yeah.
This is literature. Yeah, this is really, I mean, this is, you know, social commentary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really telling it the way people live in the inner city. Or we're living in the inner city at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Those lyrics really got my attention.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't just something to party to. You needed to listen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were like some of the first to be conscientious rappers.
And yeah.
White Lines and then a couple of songs that just made you think. It really did.
Definitely.
Yeah. But now, it's just kind of awkward. It seems like hip-hop has been taken over by another industry that doesn't want it to awaken a generation of kids. That's what it feels like. It just keeps you in a circle of this, I don't know, it's trap music. I didn't know what trap music. I live in Atlanta now, and I hear this trap music. I'm like, what are they talking about? Why do you need to tell people you are doing the worst things on the planet and over a beat? Like, why am I? These guys are like drug addicts. I hate to say this, but they sound like drug guys confessing on how much drugs they do every day and making it seem like it's something great. And now a child is listening to that. And how do you equate that to, okay, I need to study hard for my test? How do you vision that and vision these negative lyrics that are constantly put over the radio? And then back in those days, we had, I don't know, 20 rappers at one time, 30 rappers. You can go on underground station and hear some more rappers. And that was down to like 3 rappers. And it's like Drake and maybe the Migos and 2 other cats out there to choose from. And it seems like New York is gone. There's only one. Who's the rappers from New York now?
What? ASAP. The whole gang. ASAP Ferg, ASAP Rocky Hogan.
But what else? What else after ASAP?
ASAP. Mm-hmm. It's Cardi B, which I mean.
Cardi B. Did you just say Cardi B? Did y'all just say Cardi B? That's on your playlist? Cardi. Where's she coming from? And that's our role model. Come on, really? Come on. Cardi B. Hey, Shep and them, I know them. My son's actually run with them.
You was around here, Dave East.
My son's run with them. But you got Dre, Jay. Nas doesn't really come out anymore. He doesn't need to. But what happened? That's it? I mean, where do we go to listen to authentic hip hop? Like, if I want to go down south, I want to get some real barbecue chicken, or I want to go get some real, or some soul food. If I want to come to New York, I want to listen to some real rap. Where do you go for that? It's non-existent now, you know, and it's like you have cats like Drake.
Not even underground? No, you don't think so?
Nah, not in New York. Who do you
not
where
in New
you
York?
Okay.
Nowadays, underground people are like people who scream and all that.
Yeah.
There's not really anybody who really raps like that.
Then it's to the point, can you make a living from it?
Right.
You know, because
society. Only if you sell out.
Only if you sell. But now, this is the thing about hip hop. We weren't getting paid. There's a difference between getting paid for your craft.
Once there's money in it, it changes everything.
But you're able to, let's say for instance, you're rapping to be the best rapper. Mm-hmm. And so if you have someone that's a lyric like Big Daddy Kane that comes in, it's a lyricist, or you got Cool G Rapping Polo, and these rappers that come out of it that really have lyrics and speak stories, or even let's say Tupac and Biggie. These guys really could rap, and now they compete against one another. But they didn't start that way. They just spilled over into the industry. They were already battle rappers. They already could rap before that. They already went against people and they were heard, and that's how they got on. And so they continue that. Even with Jay and DMX and all those cats, they could rap before they got a deal. They're not rapping for a deal. These, you know, it's different. And so nowadays, it's just cats. Is just, to me, it's just really how much can I get? It's not about the love of it. It's about how much can I make from it.
And so often it's a springboard to something else. It's a springboard to an acting career, or it's a springboard to get endorsements. It's, mm-hmm. So...
Well, you become marketable.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
You become marketable.
It's
like
a commodity.
The Fresh Prince.
It's a commodity.
Yeah, Fresh Prince, Queen Latifah, that whole era with the Channel 5 and bringing those that hip-hop community, that hip-hop generation to television now. Now we can commercialize them. Now we can... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm trying to discreetly tell you.
Oh, fine. I'm sorry. My bad. Go ahead. What? No, I'm joking. Yeah.
So we can open it up for questions now.
I'm sorry. Any questions?
Frank, you talk a lot about the rap and what you're doing, but you didn't really kind of give us that comprehensive background on yourself that kind of brought you to where you're at today.
Uh-huh.
You're always, underselling yourself.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
So, it would be nice to hear, kind of how you got started and about your dancing career a little bit.
Oh, yeah. So, back in the days, I used to be a dancer. You know, we always battle. I used to house dance. Anybody used to go to house clubs?
Yeah.
Anybody go to clubs back in the day? I saw one hand. No one? Come on, y'all have to be over 40. Somebody got to be over 40. I wasn't going to the garage though. The garage was packed,
I went to the garage.
You went to the garage?
Yeah, I was at the garage.
Wow, all right. So you talking about the hustle.
Yeah.
Okay, we was garage, yeah.
I'm older than you.
There you go. That's all right. With all the steam coming down and all that. So anyway, we used to go to the clubs back in the day. I guess that was the late 80s. Yeah, late 80s. And so we would battle. It just spilled over from hip hop, break dancing. You get into graffiti. The next, you get into this house. Hip hop went house. You guys remember when Queen Latifah started doing the house music and Girl, I'll House You with the Jungle Brothers and all that. And so we started getting into the house music, but we were still battling each other. So we would go from, I grew up in Jersey, so we would come out to Manhattan, and we would go to, you guys know 8th Street, when they used to have Antique Boutique over there. Y'all know about Antique Boutique? It was a thrift store back in those days, a consignment shop. And so we would go over there and we'd find flyers, and we would go to the clubs that night. We'd eat at the Ray's. Well, how much were the hot dogs at Ray's? Corner, Ray Papaya. Y'all don't remember that?
Come on.
Well, please help me out on this side. Alright, so we would do all that. That would be our weekend. And I'm like 15, 16, coming out here like that, right? And so 14 actually. And partying till 3-4 in the morning. You had to bring two shirts, one to go home in, one to dance in. You know, it'd be cold walking back to that car. You know how cold it get walking back to that car, you sweating all night. So anyway, to the story. So anyway, we start battling, and we do something in Jersey. We battle these cats in Jersey, and we win. Actually, lost. We lost the battle. It was the first time we lost. And my brother, my name was On, and my partner name was Hype. So it was Hype and On. So we was getting it. He was getting in. We had our moves. And so after the end of the battle, we're outside, and this guy comes up to us, and he's like, hey, we want you to audition. I was like, audition for what? And we think, because we got a lot of weirdos. You don't know what you mean. Audition for what? We're like, what? He said, this girl named Sybil wants to actually have dances. And I was like, Sybil? Really? Get out of here. Never heard of her. She was out, but she wasn't out. You know, she had just dropped, the book just dropped.
Right.
So it's like a weekend. This is a weekend. And so we end up going to Paterson, New Jersey to, I was just telling about Paterson. We end up going out to Paterson, New Jersey to audition. So we go out there And we're thinking it's nothing, and we didn't even tell our parents. Mom, you know, you have that one friend that has his mom that will support anything she does.
That's me. I'm that mom.
She'll drive. You will drive.
Yeah, I'm
and
that mom,
over,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. So my man, he had that mom. So okay. She gave us the car. And I didn't even tell my mom. Like, I was like, this we don't know what's going to happen. She's going to tell me no anyway. So we drive out there and we audition. And Sybil comes out and she loves it. And she said, okay, the tour starts. And so I go into detail and giving his dates. And I'm like, I didn't even ask my mother. Are you kidding me? Right? And so now, and what made it horrible was Madonna had came out with Vogue and she was all like, she was this gosh. And so when I came home, I'm telling my parents, we're like old school. I'm like, Mom, Sybil wants to dance for her and go on tour and do this stuff and that. And they were like, no. I was like, what do you mean? No. And that's what I'm telling my kids now. They want to dance and do all this crazy stuff now. And it's hard for me to tell them that because I don't want them to miss out on these life opportunities. And so I argued it and to the point where I thought I was just going to wake up like next year. I thought my dad was just going to knock me out. And so they allowed me to dance for her. And I was like, Mom, I just want to dance. Let me dance, Mama. So I started dancing with Sybil. And I'm like 15 years old on tour with Sybil. And she takes us all around the United States. We're dancing and doing these routines. And we're having a lot of fun. And then I get the chance to meet with Guy. And we go on tour with these guys. We go, you name it. And then next year we go, we're in Washington, and I get a chance to perform in front of like 30,000 people, and we're out there having a great time, and we go back to the hotel, and we get a knock on the door, and it's our road manager, and they're telling us, hey, they want you guys in Paris, and I'm like, oh, great, Texas. I knew. Who knew? 15. So anyway, they want us to go to Paris, and I have to tell them, I'm like, oh, they explained it to me, and I went to get our passports, I had to tell my mom, and all this and that, but that was graffiti artist. Now you guys, I feel like I'm telling the kids at the school, I tell this stuff to the kids all the time. So I'm a graffiti artist, so I have to go back to the school, and I have to make sure that it's okay with everybody, and all my teachers clear it. And so everyone cleared it, except for my one African-American teacher. And I thought, if I tell her, she's probably got Sybil pumping in her car all day. She's like, go. No one gave me a homework assignment. And it was around Christmas, so it would be gone for 2 weeks. So I had to make sure it was clear with everybody. Math teacher, science, everybody said yes. I get to this one African-American lady. And she's actually going to come out to the show tomorrow. And she said, well, I don't know. Well, I don't think so. You're going to have a homework assignment. I said, you can't even take planes. You can't take books on planes. And I had a pencil. I don't know how to say pencil in French. I was making up anything. And she said, well, if you want me to let you go, you have to do a homework assignment. Guess what teacher it was? Thank you. My art teacher, Mrs. Moore, gave me a homework assignment to go to Paris, and I had to go to this place called the Louvre and find a particular artist. And I don't know if she knew this. How long did it take to walk through the Louvre?
A couple days, at least.
3 days. Yeah. 3 days the minimum. Yeah. Right? And I'm thinking, I've never been to a museum before in my life, to that point. That was the first museum I've been to. And actually, I'd never even been to an art gallery at that point. And so I get to Paris, and of course, my role manager knew about it, my parents knew about it, Sybil knew about it, and I thought everyone forgot because we were there like 3 days, and no one said go to the Louvre. So I'm like, oh, great, I don't have to do this. Now, up until that point, like I kept saying earlier, I was what? What kind of artist? You could tell me about Picasso, I'm talking about Rembrandt. I could care less because they're not the guys that write on the walls in my neighborhood or the ones I admire. So I'm sitting here like, okay, so hype. I said, all right, we're going to be, well, I'll be right back. We had high tops, you know, the high tops and all that stuff. And so I'm like, okay, you know, we're asking for directions. No one speaks English. And we even go up to these brothers that were African. I was like, oh, maybe just wearing dashikis and whatever. And they don't even speak, they're speaking African to us. I'm like, well, how are we going to find out? And so eventually someone tells us, they points us in a direction. I said, that can't be it, because that looks like a church. That's not, that's a whole block. That we're not looking for a church. We're looking for the Louvre. And of course, you get there, and the doors are literally the size of this building when you walk in. And I tell my partner, I'm like, yo, hype, I'll be right back. Give me like 15 minutes. You know what I mean? I'll be right back, man. And I'm like, I don't care about this stuff. I'm going to grab this and come right back. Maybe it's in the front, right? I get in there and I am, as soon as the doors open, I'm done. I'm done. And it changed my life. Changed my life. I've never seen paintings, frescoes this large. And I'm looking at the victory. I'm looking at all these. And we go around the corner, we see David.
Do you remember what artist you were looking for? Oh. She told you to look for?
I'll ask her tomorrow.
Okay. Scavenger hunt.
I have no idea. You're still being there like that? I have no idea what I was looking for. But anyway, I go in there and I'm looking around and we're just amazed. And my mouth, and thank God my hype was into art. Well, he was just in to support me, or he was too scared to walk off without me and walk around. We didn't have cell phones back then. We were like, hey, yo, I'm over here. That's all you had to communicate. So anyway, we walked around that museum for like, I don't even know how long. It was hours. But then we get in this line. And I'm like, well, we're in Paris. I guess we wait. Maybe something to eat. Maybe they serving something over here forever. Right? And so we get in this line. And one by one, we walk up. And one by one. I'm looking, everybody's staring at this painting. I'm like, what the hell is this? What is it? What is this?
The Mona Lisa.
How you gonna give it away?
The Mona Lisa.
The Mona Lisa. His kid from Jersey now was sitting in front of the Mona Lisa. Could care less about Leonardo da Vinci up until this point, and she's got this glass around her, and you're about 40 feet away from her, and I'm just sitting there, like, amazed. And for some reason or another, Charles Schwartz was there with Peanuts for somehow. I don't know how that makes sense. I don't know if that was a dream I had, but Snoopy. I don't know why. Charlie Brown was not far away from that. That changed me. And then that would got me into why I'm painting now. Yeah, I would be a writer somewhere. But I realized that it took more than letters to be an artist. And I knew that there was a history behind art. And then it just really threw me into it. Then I went back to Paris, and you guys remember the song Pump Up the Jam? Mm-hmm. You guys know that? Oh, so everybody knows that now, right? You guys know the controversy behind it? There was a girl that didn't look as attractive, so they had to redo everything because they had to make this, because she sued. And she was like, well, someone stand in for her. And so she wanted to be in the forefront. This is a hit for her. So anyway, we're in Paris, and we're at the Cannes Film Festival now. And we're seeing we fly in, and it has these beautiful pastel colors on top of the beach, like there's a beach line and a shoreline with all these homes. And we're in there, and we do our performance, and after the end of the performance, I meet up with Rosie Perez. We see Rosie Perez. You guys know who Rosie is? Yeah. I can only tell you the story because my wife's not here. So we meet up with Rosie, and I'm like, hey, Rosie, where y'all going tonight? And she gives me her number, and I'm like, oh, well, get out of here. We're going to go. And my partner takes it from me. And I'm like, why you take the number? And of course, he loses the number. So she tells us to go to Club A, and we go to Club B. And we go to Club B, and we're looking around, and no one's in there. No one's in this club except for these old dudes and this kid in a corner, and they're playing this music. You got a couple of cats, but everybody's like the old heads. We're like, where the dancers at? So anyway, I go in the back and I see this young kid back there and he's writing. And I'm like, oh, what are you writing, man? Are you a writer? I think he's a graffiti artist. And he's writing poems. So what the hell's wrong with you? We're in a club writing poems. You in love like that? What are you writing poems like that? Right? And then he dances for Digital Underground. This guy comes up to me and he's sitting there like, yeah, you guys got it, huh? But you guys come up to me, they're like, oh, yo, Frank, because they knew we were from New York area. And they were like, you think this song's gonna be a hit? It's called the Humpty Hump. And I'm like, they played it for us. And I'm like, yeah, maybe. Yeah, that's hot. That's hot. And it ends up being like a smash, right? And then to come to find out that guy that was writing, who was it?
Tupac.
What? No. Yeah, Tupac. Little humble guy in the corner, chilling, writing on notebooks, right? And I'm like, come on, man, really? And he was scared of us, you know? And I was like, okay, it was the hot top. So anyway, then we get these other guys come in, and we're like, nah, we're trying to get down. Like, Rosie, nobody's here. We're gonna get out of here. And so, but these other guys come up, and they had probably seen our performance earlier that day. And they said, well, could you do us a favor? Could you dance for us? We're doing the Apollo. We're doing Showtime at, well, it's not Showtime at Apollo. We did that earlier. They're doing this thing called Rap Mania. And that's half the people in this book I met during that event. These guys came up with this song called a Hip Hop, a Hip Hop. You don't stop. It's the Sugar Hill Gang. And then so they asked us if we could perform with them on Rap Mania. And so that was actually not too far from here in Harlem and on 125th at the, you guys know the Apollo. That was my little hip hop thing. That's what I did in hip hop going
we
on.
We can have maybe two more questions. All right. I would love to hear Carol's story too. If you want to talk about your journey with poetry, how you got into publishing, that might be nice to hear.
Okay, I started writing in first grade. Made up a poem, dictated to my mom on the way home. I was fortunate enough to have a father who was a high school printing teacher, and he printed some of my early poems on the press in his classroom. There was no such thing as computers back then, so that meant that I got to see my work in print at a very early age before there was the dawn of desktop publishing. I did not dare dream of being an author because at that time, because I had never met a real live author. Although I loved books, I had no idea that the people who were writing them were alive or getting paid to do that work. So I did not decide that I wanted to be an author until after I was published by someone other than my father in some place other than a school publication in my mid-20s. And I had a poem published that much like that first poem that I wrote in first grade, came to me out of the blue. The poem was called I'm Made of Jazz. It was a rhyming poem and a tribute, much like this. It wasn't as didactic as this, but it was a celebration of jazz, and it talked about people like Lena Horne and Bessie Smith and Louis Armstrong and John Coltrane and the jazz luminaries. And once that poem was published, I declared myself a poet and set out to be a published author and came to children's books many years, over a decade later, when I became a mother myself and noticed that there were more multicultural and diverse books for my children than there had been for me. And I decided that rather than writing poetry for adults, I would try my hand at writing poetry for children, and succeeded at it. Got my foot in the door, and 55 books later.
Wow. How is that possible?
Wow. No, for real. Like, seriously. Can you talk a little bit about longevity? Like, to your point earlier when you all were talking, like, some people just want to kind of get on, right?
Right.
And those artists don't normally stay. They don't have lasting power.
Right. Well, in a word, you know, it's possible because, I've been in the business since 1995. Most people don't have this kind of staying power, but I've kind of carved a niche for myself writing poetry that's informational. So I write poetry that may be biographies, poetry that's not about real life, nonfiction topics. But also, it's because I tell kids, writing is not what I do, it's who I am. So I'm going to write whether it makes it between the covers of a book or not. You know, this is a blessing to be able to do what I think I was put on this planet to do and to get paid for it. But I'm going to do it whether I get paid for it or not. But I'm able to identify topics that are, have not been written about before for kids, topics that are obscure, subjects that I think kids need to know about, forgotten heroes. My mission as an author is to mine the past for family stories, fading traditions, and forgotten struggles. And I stick to that for the most part, and I write not only about long ago history, but contemporary history. I guess, you know, I've just been fortunate. My writing resonates not only with young readers, but also with critics, with reviewers, and I've been able to stay in the business. I feel fortunate, as you know, that I've been able to do that, and this is my contribution.
Ballpark, how long does it take from the time you write a first draft to the time it gets published?
The shortest amount of time has been 11 months, and that was for a book about the Obama's dog that was time sensitive and needed to get out before all the other books. You know, there was a race to write about Obama's dog. My book was not the first; it was probably the fifth or so. The longest amount of time has been 7 years because my book was orphaned, meaning I lost an editor in the process. So, yeah, but normally anywhere from 18 months to 2 or 3 years, depending on the size, how large the size of the publishing house.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, Frank can call on people too, but yeah.
Oh, no, I like to hear
What poets did you read growing up?
Langston Hughes. Okay. Langston Hughes. Langston Hughes was the first black poet that I read, and I was introduced to him in school by a fourth grade teacher named Mrs. Fuller. Before that, I was reading nursery rhymes and other poems for kids in anthologies that relatives gave me. Langston Hughes. And then when I was a young adult in college and out of college, I was reading poets from the Black Arts Movement who had been influenced by spoken word, E.G. Abani, Hakeem Olajuwon when he was still Donnell B., Etheridge Knight, and others, Leroy Jones, Amira Baraka,
yeah.
Maya Angelou,
Eldridge Cleaver,
yeah. Dudley Randall, I was buying his books that were published by Broadside Press.
You mentioned both, you alluded to your work with youth. I know you mentioned you're a college professor, a curriculum, and then you also talked about high school students. So I'm just curious about your work with young people and what that looks like.
Mine looks like a job.
Okay.
Because I'm a college professor. That's my day job.
Right.
Teaching is what I can do. Mm-hmm. Writing is what I was put here to do.
Mm-hmm.
So my teaching is my way of sharing that. It's another way of sharing that. But I do school visits with kids, and I share my own poems that are influenced by spoken word. I do writing workshops with kids. I do professional development with teachers, both for school systems and also at conferences. But it looks, the work that I do with kids who are like in K-12, it looks like fun to me. The work that I do with college kids, it looks like a job. It feels like a job because I have to grade their work. Yeah, that takes the fun out of it. The great.
So I have a question for both of you. When did you know this is what you wanted to do? Was there an event that happened where the light bulb went on, where you knew you were going to tune everything else out and this is what you were going to do?
Well, for me, it was the poem that I wrote called I'm Made of Jazz. It was, as I said, it was the second poem came to me out of the blue. I think the first poem that I wrote when I was 6 years old that came out of the blue, and I recited it to my mother, was God's way of letting my parents know that they had a child who had a gift that needed to be nurtured. I was into many, many other creative endeavors, from painting to sewing and fashion design, photography. I was into darkroom photography. And my parents, my mom was that mom who supported anything I wanted to do. You know, okay, we'll take you to lessons here. And this was in the segregation era, too. So you had to, you know, really, and also in an era when kids weren't pushed as hard and overscheduled, and you had to really find things to channel your child in if they were interested in the arts outside of school. So the first poem, I was 6 years old, and then 24 years old, the poem I Made of Jazz came to me out of the blue at the moment when I was about to pursue what I thought was a very practical career, because I had not been able to find a job in the career that I trained for in undergrad, which was public relations. I had decided, well, I'm going to get a master's in public administration. And I got a full ride to graduate school, had a fellowship, and then this poem came out the summer before I was to start, it was published. And I saw that poem, and I went to school, and I got my stack of papers from the professor that I was supposed to be doing the research assistant for, had a research assistantship, I can't even remember what the research was, but it was a stack of papers and there were some numbers and yeah. I went to one class and then I walked away from the fellowship and said, I'm a poet. So it was seeing that poem, I Made of Jazz in print. And I think that poem, that as I said, came to me in a piece out of the blue, the same way that first poem had, that was God's way of getting my attention and said, wait a minute, I put you here to do something else. If you do this, I will look after you.
Well, mine's nothing like
that. And then 15 years later, I had my first book published, so it was not an overnight success.
Wow. Mine was different. I was, it was weird because it happened exactly the way you said it. It's going to sound corny. But especially with, I should have went first. But I was watching the Essence Awards, and it came on, and this is probably like 1993. I was drawing, but I was paying more attention to the awards than what was on my drawing. And something told me, if you're gonna take this series, turn the TV off. For some reason or other, that just resonated with me. And it just made me block out anything that was gonna distract me from becoming an artist. And so I saw at that point I had signed with Essence. I don't know if you guys remember Essence magazine. Mm-hmm. They used to have the Essence catalog. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys know, I'm a fine artist, so I have hundreds of images on the market. I've been painting all my life, but I was published at the age of 17. Mm-hmm. That's when I signed with Essence Art.
Oh, you were late bloomer, huh?
Yeah. So I signed with Essence at 17. And something just told me, literally, just to take this serious. And till today, I just go off into a corner, and I just, when it's time to paint or time to draw, tonight I'll be painting till 3 a.m. I've just built that work ethic. And you know, I'll paint and paint and paint when I'm working on the picture books and just go on for hours. But is there some point in your life you realize with children, that's what I try to teach them, mm-hmm. or let them know, is that we all have a talent. You all have a talent, and it's about hearing that calling and paying attention to it and doing what you need to do to progress and become who you want to be in life.
I had a child ask me yesterday at one of my schools, what if you don't have a passion or a talent? And this was, he might have been a junior or a sophomore or something. Well, he wasn't a junior because no juniors were there. He probably was a sophomore or a senior. But I said, everybody has a talent. It's not always evident at first. And you might be 6 or you might be 17 mm-hmm. or you might be 70 when it becomes evident. And every talent, every gift, every passion is not something that you can channel into a career and make money either. You know, some people have a talent that might be being compassionate and being a good listener. It's not always something that's going to be very, real practical necessarily. But yeah, I think everybody has a gift, everybody has a talent of some sort.